You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
Charlotte Howard, the healthcare correspondent for The Economist, notes that America's become the fattest country in the Western world, and obesity-related illness accounts for over one-fifth of total healthcare spending. But any governmental attempt to reverse the trend is quickly labeled as a possible infringement on individuals' freedom of choice. Why has obesity become such a problem, and what can be done to correct it? Ms. Howard wrote a special report on obesity for the December 15th issue of The Economist called The Big Picture, and I'm very pleased it has brought her to our show today. Welcome.
Thank you.
How many Americans are overweight, and how is being overweight defined?
About two-thirds of American adults are overweight or obese. So the technical definition for that is, for overweight, is having a BMI of 25 or more, which is about 170 pounds for someone who's 5'9". You're obese, technically, if you have a BMI of 30 or over, which is about over 200 pounds for the same height.
So it's a difference between Rubens and Botero. There's a report in today's newspapers that a new study of nearly 3 million people whose BMIs ranked them as overweight found that they had less risk of dying than people of normal weight, but that obese people have a higher risk. So what happens there? It seems that you just simply cross a line and you suddenly your whole situation changes.
Well, what's really interesting about this new study, it was published just this week in the Journal of the American Medical Association, is that it shows that if you're overweight or moderately obese, you may actually have a lower risk of mortality than those of what's deemed normal weight of a BMI of roughly 18 to 25. That doesn't, however, mean that people who are overweight or obese are healthy. That is, they may have higher rates of chronic disease. So one of the very interesting things about the obesity problem is that it doesn't necessarily mean that people will start dying at much younger ages, but it does mean that people will likely develop chronic diseases at higher rates. And that poses a particular challenge to governments because, as we know, the longer you live sick, the more costs there are for the government, which may be paying for your care, and the more costs that you yourself may pay out of pocket.
A study done by Tulane University predicted that if nothing is done, about 3.3 billion people in the world will be obese by 2030. Is that a reasonable prediction? Because there are other people like Dr. Liebel of Columbia University who says that Americans may be reaching our biological limit for obesity.
Right. So the obesity trends are playing out differently across the world. It's pretty well known within the United States that America has an obesity problem, and it's been rising over the past 30 or 40 years. But one of the more interesting findings in recent years have been research done of obesity rates all over the world, which show a dramatic rise since 1980. So the person who's done the most work on this is a researcher named Majid Azadi out of London, at Imperial College London. And in his most comprehensive count of this, there were about one in three adults who were overweight in 2008. And that's just a staggering, staggering number. If you think about in mankind's history, the main problem being not having enough food, that all of a sudden we would be worried about the world eating too much food is staggering. So if you think about obesity trends around the world, even if they were to remain where they are at the current where they are now, it would still pose a huge challenge to health systems around the world as they try to treat people who are developing diabetes, heart disease, and it would also pose a huge challenge to food systems with a greater demand on the world's food supply.
Now, how does this compare to the 1980s?
In 1980, we have our obesity rates today are about double what they were worldwide in 1980. So today, 12% are obese. And as I said, about one in three are overweight. And the obesity rates are about double what they were in 1980.
Now, where are the highest obesity rates in developing countries?
It really varies. Some of the world's highest obesity rates, surprisingly, are in the Pacific Islands and in parts of the Middle East. In North America, Mexico's obesity rates are about as high as the United States, which may come as a shock to some. But they really vary. Britain has high obesity rates. About 1 in 4 adults are obese. But in parts of Europe, obesity rates are pretty low, in Switzerland, for example, and in France. So it varies from one country to the next.
But higher in
trend globally.
Higher in the Czech Republic for some reason.
Yeah, exactly. So there are different trends that are playing out across the world. There's a broad trend that happens with economic growth, that as countries become richer, people generally have more food. They have different kinds of food, more meat, more processed foods. They may exercise less as they move from fields into the cities and spend more time at desk jobs. But how these trends play out from one country to the next is quite different. So in the Middle East, for example, you have rapid growth in wealth combined with sedentary lifestyles because it's so hot and because there may be cultural restrictions. So in different parts of the world, these trends play out slightly differently. But globally, there's been a general steady rise since 1980.
Well, in the United Arab Emirates, we see the world's highest female obesity rates. And aren't women more likely to be obese than men?
In general, women are more likely to be obese than men. They've had a bigger rise globally than men have since 1980. And one can account for this in many different ways, and it varies, from one region to the next, but it may have something to do with more sedentary lifestyles.
The second developing country with high female obesity rates is South Africa, and the United States comes in number 3?
I think that's right. I don't have the figures in front of me, but there are very high, obesity rates among women from one region to the next. Interestingly, in the United States, there have been some groups for which obesity rates seem to be at least leveling off, but overall rates remain very high.
My guest is Charlotte Howard, the healthcare correspondent for The Economist. Her article in the December 15th issue of The Economist was called The Big Picture, and it's about obesity and related matters. Is there such a thing as being predisposed to obesity? Is there an obesity gene that has been found?
There's not one single obesity gene, but there are an array of genes that may make people more disposed to becoming obese than others. But the rise in obesity that you've seen over the past several decades can't be explained by genetics. It's simply not enough time for there to have been a big shift in humanity's genetics. So rather, it's a difference in environmental factors. It's a difference in the way people are living, the type of food available to them, rather than any sort of shift in mankind's genome.
So it's not just a matter of how much we eat, but also what we eat?
Certainly there are certain foods that seem to contribute to obesity. There are different hypotheses for this. There's a professor out of Harvard named Richard Wrangham who argues that processed foods may be contributing to the obesity epidemic because they're more easily digested. It takes less energy to digest processed foods, and they may be digested more completely, so the body absorbs more calories. There's obviously a big debate over the role of soda. We're sitting here in New York City where the mayor has targeted soda. Soda is liquid, and it has a ton of sugar with no nutritional value. The body doesn't seem to recognize calories from liquids in the way that it does from solid foods. So if you imagine our ancestors on the savanna, if they got full from drinking water, they wouldn't have fared very well. So the body may be less able to recognize calories from liquids than from solid foods. But there's quite a lot of debate over which foods are more to blame. Some researchers think that sugar is the main culprit, but this is a really active area of research.
In Mexico, they're blaming Coca-Cola, aren't they?
Well, that's one of the factors that people blame. Mexicans consume more soda, more Coca-Cola per year than any other than the people of any other country. I think the number is 728 servings of soda the average person drinks per year. So that's quite a staggering number. But there are likely other factors at work as well.
Well, in Mexico, Coca-Cola actually does taste better because they use sugar. They don't use corn fructose or whatever we use to sweeten those things. Maybe it's just it tastes better, or do you think sugar itself is actually more dangerous than all these corn sweeteners?
I haven't seen research that sugar is more dangerous than corn sweeteners. I think that the body processes them in the same way, but that may be open to debate. But I don't think that eating sugar specifically rather than corn syrup can be blamed for Mexico's high rates of obesity.
As countries become wealthier, we see the proportion of meat to vegetables in many people's diets change. Do you think that that's playing a role?
Well, one of the things that's so interesting about this problem around the world is that there just is no single factor that can be blamed on rising obesity rates. One could say that it's soda. One could say that it's rising meat consumption or oil consumption. One could say that it has to do with eating refined carbohydrates, white rice, or not exercising enough. And the truth is that it's probably all of these things. And from one region to the next, these factors play out differently. And this complex range of factors that are driving the obesity epidemic is what makes it just so hard to tackle. You can't just go after soda. You can't just try to improve exercise. It's very, very complicated to reverse rates because of the wide range of factors that are driving them up.
For example, you say undernourished mothers produce babies who are predisposed to gaining weight easily. On the other hand, in China, doting grandparents shower edible treats on their scarce grandchildren. So in that case, the one-child policy may be playing a part.
Yeah, I mean, that's a great example of just the range of factors that could be driving obesity from one country to the next. As you say, in China, I was speaking with different people who say that the one-child policy means that you have, you know, four grandparents for just one very spoiled grandchild, and so they end up getting all kinds of treats. Chinese people often eat with a sort of lazy Susan in the middle table with various dishes, and it may be that before there would just be two different dishes on the lazy Susan, and now there are five at the average meal, but people are still helping themselves to the same quantity from each plate. So, you know, it really, really varies from one region to the next, but on the whole, you do see this general upward trend, whether you're talking about the UAE, which I visited for this report, which has very high rates of obesity, or China, or Brazil, or Mexico, or right here in the United States. And so the factors are somewhat different from each region to the next, but there is a general similarity in these rising rates.
I'd like to bring a doctor into this discussion. Jeff from Morristown has called in. You're a cardiologist?
Yes, I am. Thanks for having me on the show for a moment. I just wanted to comment on some previous discussion. I'm not aware of any data that fructose tastes different from table sugar, but there's research out today. I wish I could quote for you the exact source, but it's in the news today that fructose doesn't suppress hunger the same way that regular sugar does, and so that you can take a larger quantity, still feel hungry. And there's other data, plenty of data showing that the body metabolizes fructose differently from glucose and sucrose.
So fructose could be a little more dangerous if you're worrying about your weight.
You could be more prone to eat or drink more of it and not feel satisfied, and so you would take more of it and more calories that way, yes.
Thank you so much for calling.
Thank you.
Charlotte, before we go to a break and cover other kinds of material, I mentioned that undernourished mothers produce babies who are predisposed to gaining weight easily. Can you explain how that works?
You know, I'm not an expert in how that works. I think that it has to do with the body's sort of natural defenses. If you're in an environment, you develop ways to cope with that environment. So if you're undernourished, then you become better at maintaining the calories that you do have. One thing that's an interesting piece of recent research shows how the body adapts to losing weight. This is obviously well after birth for adults who go on diets. But there are different factors that control hunger and control your feeling of fullness. And when one goes on a diet, ghrelin, which is one hormone that tells you that you're hungry, that remains elevated, and leptin, something that tells you that you're full, remains depressed even a year after the person has gone on a diet. And so what this shows is that the body has all kinds of mechanisms to promote weight gain. We've evolved to try to keep calories and keep weight up because that was a problem that humans traditionally had, is not having enough food. We don't have many mechanisms to prevent weight gain. We've evolved for precisely the opposite. So the body has a range of different mechanisms to help keep on weight. This modern phenomenon of being too fat, we're very ill-equipped biologically to deal with.
So we're storing calories for the famine to come, but we're not living in a famine situation right now.
That's exactly right.
Charlotte Howard's article, The Big Picture, is in the December 15th issue of The Economist. We'll continue our conversation after we take a little break. Stay with us. And we are back with Charlotte Howard, whose article, The Big Picture, appeared in the December 15th issue of The Economist, where she is the healthcare correspondent. Let's talk a bit about health. What are some possible health defects caused by obesity?
Diabetes, type 2 diabetes, is a very commonly cited one, but heart disease as well. And it seems that obesity rates are also linked with higher rates of cancer and a likelihood of dying from those cancers.
Certain kinds of cancers, I would assume.
Exactly, different kinds of cancers.
Do we have any idea why? I mean, cancer just seems to be, that's cells running amok. How would that be caused by obesity?
It may be because of excess insulin, and which is something that's made by the pancreas and helps shuttle sugar to cells. So it may be that insulin shuttles glucose to cancer cells and promotes growth, but this is a really active area of research.
And they're also looking into it as having an effect on mental health?
It may have an effect on, I think there are some studies showing effects on mental health, and then there are also sort of less biological, but perhaps effects of obesity on depression, et cetera. But the really big one that is most closely correlated is diabetes, which occurs when insulin, the body stops responding to insulin properly. The pancreas starts pumping out more and more insulin. There are very high levels of sugar in the blood, which can lead to all kinds of following conditions, as people are likely familiar with, in the worst case scenario, the loss of a limb or blindness, kidney disease. So these are serious conditions. And one of the things that's interesting about obesity is that obesity comes on so steadily, and it's very hard for people to associate one donut now with the loss of your foot in 10 years. It's not a clear chain of action. And so that makes driving behavior more difficult. If the repercussions of obesity were immediately more obvious, it might be easier to prevent obesity from coming on in the first place.
You mentioned earlier that there is something in the body that tells us we're hungry and remains there if we're dieting even a year later. Is that why it's so hard for people to keep weight off that they've lost in a diet?
That's one of the reasons, yes. And I think that there's science increasingly shows the way in which the body makes it very hard to keep weight off. So often people assume that failed diets are simply the result of individual frailty. People just don't have the willpower to keep the weight off, when in fact the body's designed to help you gain that weight back. As I mentioned earlier, we've evolved to help promote weight gain rather than weight loss. And so there are all kinds of signals that go off in your body that tell you to gain that weight back. One of the interesting things that's been observed in obese people is changes within the brain. So the obese are conditioned to the sight of sugary food. When you eat a sugary food, the brain releases dopamine, which helps signal pleasure and motivates you. In obese people, they have fewer dopamine receptors. That means that when you eat a sugary food, you actually get less pleasure from eating it, which one hypothesis goes may drive compulsive eating. But all of these factors suggest that it's not just a lack of character or willpower that prevents people from eating healthily. There are biological mechanisms within the body that make it very, very hard to keep weight off.
And overweight people are often angered by the kind of judgmental reactions to people seeing them shoveling the food in.
Certainly there's discrimination against, I think the causes of obesity and why it's so hard to lose, gain weight are really just starting to be understood, and society has yet to catch up. And I think you see this in some of the public policy debate over what to do about obesity. It's very, very hard, as we were discussing earlier, to reverse the obesity epidemic because there are so many factors that influence it. But another problem is that many people simply think that the obesity epidemic would be reversed if people just ate less. And, of course, that's true. But it's not simply a matter of telling people stop eating so much. It's much more complicated than that. And so that prevents, I think that attitude towards obesity prevents different public policy measures. A public policy measure to combat obesity is less popular if people simply think there's an easy solution, fat people can control this themselves, why don't they just start eating less? So it gets to a very sort of tricky part of the obesity debate, this question of what can be done and who should be responsible.
My guest is Charlotte Howard, the healthcare correspondent for The Economist. Her article, The Big Picture About Obesity, was in the December 15th issue of The Economist. This is WNYC, WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. We have been getting responses from our listeners. One caller wanted to know if there's any connection between smoking and lower obesity rates in Europe, because Europeans are more likely to smoke. Many people have noted that, me, and I'm just one of those examples. When I quit smoking, it got harder for me to keep my weight down.
I mean, I think that smoking does suppress the appetite, so that may be a factor. In Europe, there are also there's just a different culture of eating, and the cities are more walkable. People spend more time commuting to work or walking to do their errands rather than being in the car. So perhaps smoking may have something to do with it, but I think there are many other factors as well.
And people do point out that in New York, where a lot of people walk, we have lower obesity rates than in other parts of the country.
That's certainly true, though I would point out that obesity rates vary widely within the city, with much higher rates in the Bronx, for example, than in on the Upper East Side. So there is something having to do with urban planning, but also certainly income and education are inversely correlated with obesity.
And the fact that more people rely on fast foods in certain parts of the city than others?
Yes, that may be true.
Aren't fast food chains saying that they're going to do things to lower obesity rates?
Well, the food industry's response, food industry meaning both fast food restaurants as well as the huge multinational food companies that are expanding so rapidly throughout the world, every big food company has some kind of nutrition plan. They're very nervous about being seen as the next tobacco. They don't want to be subject to the same kinds of regulations that cigarette companies have been subject to in recent decades. So they're making a big push to say that they will help solve the obesity crisis rather than contribute to it. And so they're reformulating some products that is taking fat or sugar or salt out. They're introducing healthier ones. But there are many public health advocates who say that change isn't coming fast enough. And there is this problem that the people like buying junk food. Junk food tastes delicious. And as long as people buy unhealthy food, food companies have a duty to their shareholders to keep selling it. And it's this kind of tension of this sort of, appropriately enough, a chicken and egg problem for the food companies that makes some people argue for greater regulation. They say food companies simply won't change quickly enough unless there's stronger pressure from the government. But the food companies say, we'll take care of this. We can't be demonized in the way that a tobacco company can be. And I think they are right in that argument. I mean, you can have a chocolate bar every day of your life and still be healthy, depending on your other habits. You can't smoke a pack of cigarettes every day and be healthy. So there's a lot of tension right now between food companies and advocates who say that they aren't moving quickly enough.
Well, when Mayor Bloomberg suggested taxing large sodas, there was an incredible pushback from the public as well as from the industry. I mean, he wasn't saying that we should outlaw sugary drinks. He simply said we should tax them, especially when they're marketed in large quantities.
So soda taxes have been proposed not just in New York but around the country. One thing that was unique about the mayor's proposal is that it was a much higher tax rate than those that have been implemented by other cities or states. Most cities or states that have thought about soda taxes have had very, very minor taxes, not enough to change consumption patterns in any real way. And the mayor wanted to do something much more aggressive.
Similar to what we've done to cigarettes.
Exactly. So cigarette taxes are very high, as any smoker would know. It's worth remembering that there was a huge outcry to cigarette taxes in the beginning as well. This may be just be part of the progression of how we think about policy targeting either cigarettes or sodas. But part of the debate about sodas is that people worry it would be regressive. That is, poor people spend a greater share of their income on food and beverages than do rich people. So this would have a bigger effect on those with lower incomes. The mayor would argue that people don't have to drink soda. Soda has a disproportionate effect on the poor, so therefore a tax is justified. But there's a very healthy debate, to put it mildly, on this issue.
Let's bring a caller in. Amy from New Jersey. Hi, you're on the air.
Hi. My question was another public policy side, and that was about crop subsidies. And I was wondering, one of the reasons that you see poor people tend to be inverse correlation to weight is because subsidized crops like wheat and corn are so cheap. I was wondering if internationally that also holds true. When you look at countries that have more obesity, can you correlate it at all with national policies in terms of crop subsidies and imports?
That's a fantastic question, and I'm very sorry to say that I don't have a good answer for it internationally. I'm not aware of research that shows internationally the effect of subsidies on obesity rates. I can say that in the United States, it intuitively makes sense that corn subsidies, which are very high here, would have had an effect on obesity rates. The research, however, is not as clear as one would think. The most comprehensive analysis that I've seen and I think that has been done is by a group from Cornell, and they found that if you eliminated grain subsidies completely, it would have a very, very minor effect on consumption. The effect of subsidies on food prices over time has fallen, even as obesity rates have continued to rise. And in fact, if you eliminated all subsidies, including grain subsidies, which would make things like corn syrup more expensive, but also different restrictions for dairy and sugar. Right now, our agricultural policies make those artificially expensive, so those would become cheaper, that people would actually consume more calories. So it's not as clear as one would think intuitively that doing away with corn subsidies would all of a sudden lead to a drop in calorie consumption.
Don't many people think that the real answer is to just approach this as a problem with children, get them to change their eating habits? Michelle Obama is actively involved in anti-obesity campaigns, especially with school lunches, although there's been a pushback there as well, people complaining about the nanny state.
So yes, the First Lady definitely made children the target of her anti-obesity campaign. It does make sense to target children in some ways for several reasons. First of all, if you can keep children from becoming obese early, that's much easier than having massive weight loss across adults. As I've explained, it's just very, very hard biologically to lose weight and keep it off. It can be done, but it's very hard. So it makes more sense to prevent obesity rather than try to reverse it. Also, for children, you have this great institution known as the school where you can control what they're eating through the school lunches. You can have more time for kids for running around, so you can try to ingrain healthy habits. And also, paternalism is just more appropriate for children than for adults. Paternalism has the word pater in it. It's more appropriate for young people. So that definitely is a more active area, an area where you would think there'd be more consensus for support, but it is still quite controversial.
A listener, Joseph, asks if there are any studies on how the introduction of computers have made people gain weight in different cultures. I guess he's thinking about people sitting in front of a computer all day and not being as active as they would have been in the past. Also, of course, automobiles have been playing a role in this, but we've had cars for over a century now, and the obesity problem, as you point out, has doubled in the last 30 years.
Right. So certainly sedentary, a trend toward a more sedentary lifestyle seems to be linked with rising obesity rates, both because of the use of cars, but also just work, spending more time in front of a desk with a computer rather than doing manual labor. But I don't know specifically of studies that look at computer use and obesity. There's been a ton of research in the past year showing the effect of sitting on health, just how bad it is for you to sit at your desk all day. And so I think the argument in favor of more exercise is clear for health. However, it also is worth noting that when we're talking about obesity in particular, that the vast majority of researchers say that the easiest way to try to combat obesity is through changes in diet rather than just changes in exercise, exercise alone isn't going to reverse the obesity epidemic. So you really have to think about ways to get people to eat more healthily.
Charlotte Howard is the healthcare correspondent for The Economist. Her article, The Big Picture, was in the December 15th issue of that publication. And I want to thank you so much for being with us today.
Thank you for having me.